Welcome, everyone. Welcome here. This is a class on preparation. Our goal, our purpose is to identify areas that teachers need to prepare for. They need to focus on specifically so that they're ready to teach when it's time to teach. Have you ever seen this before? I know some of you had. Some of you became intimately acquainted with this book. This is from the CLE teacher training course, and this is my primary source. You ever see this book? This is a good book to have. You can buy them online for 99 cents pretty much any day of the year, and then pay your $3.99 for shipping and you have it. This book invites browsing. You can open it almost anywhere, and it's good stuff. I opened it to page 94. It says, the three most important words to a painter, a pilot, or a chef are preparation, preparation, preparation. The three most important words to a teacher are preparation, preparation, preparation. That's good stuff. A lot of pithy information in this book. So you got started on filling out your little form with blanks, right? Ben, we don't want you leaving going blank, blank, blank. We want you to have something in there. If you wish, this is actually something that you might have with you when you're preparing to teach in a few weeks. You might just lay this on your desk and keep scanning across it. Not necessarily every motion that you need to do will be on this paper, but the big picture areas are. The first is prepare in prayer. Prepare in prayer. Jonah already mentioned this. This man, Bruce Wilkinson, says that teachers impact more by their character and commitment than by their communication. Now let me read that again. Get it this time. Right? We know that teachers are to communicate, right? And your primary job is not going to be flipping pepperonis on pizza. It's not going to be using the table saw. It's going to be being a communicator, right? However, teachers impact more by their character and commitment than their communication. Does that scare you a little bit? It scares me a little, more than a little. Here we thought teaching was about communication of academic material, right? And it is, and it is. But your character and your commitment, the things that you're committed to, are going to communicate more than what you actually communicate. It's true. You know Psalm 51. I'm going to read you a few portions of it. Psalm 51 is that one that says, have mercy upon me, O God, according to thy loving kindness, according to the multitude of thy tender mercies, blot out my transgressions. Sensing a need for mercy. Verse 2 talks about washing, being cleansed. Verse 3, I acknowledge my transgressions, being honest with mistakes. Verse 6, I desire truth in the inward parts. I want that inner plumb line, that standard of righteousness. Verse 8 talks about, make me to hear joy and gladness. Verse 9, hide thy face from my sins. Verse 10, create in me a clean heart, O God. Verse 12, restore unto me the joy of thy salvation. And then verse 13, all of a sudden, burst forth with what? Then will I teach. Read it for yourself. If Psalm 51 is accurate, and it is, it's accurate so far as the way we people are wired, there's a certain spiritual position that we can teach from, and then there's a certain spiritual position that we can't teach from, right? It's one thought that scares me, summarized in a title of a book that I saw not so long ago. It was titled Leading on Empty. Leading on Empty. And it had this subtitle. It says, Why Bad Things Happen in God's Family. Too many people, too many leaders are trying to lead on empty. That's why we need to prepare in prayer. I'm just going to be real open here with you. And I wrote down, what is it, seven or so things that I prayed pretty frequently as I taught. as I taught, as I talked, yes. The one was just simply, give me what it takes. Give me what it takes. Do I have enough Christ in me to do this work? Another one that I prayed for, maybe you won't need to pray this as often as I did, but I needed to pray for patience. Lord, give me patience. Help me not to be frustrated today. Frustration in leadership is always, always a negative. It's always bad. Frustration never produces something good. Frustration in leadership. Calmness is always a strength. I got a lot of inspiration out of the duck. If you watch a duck swim on the top, it's all peaceful, serene, progress. But you know what's going on down underneath, right? It's going like crazy down underneath, right? It's all right to be going like crazy inwardly, but outwardly, part of successful teaching is keeping your patience more evident than all that paddling beneath the surface. Another thing I prayed for fairly frequently is each student individually, talking about preparing to teach. The way I would do it is I just pray around the room. I knew where my students sat, and it was pretty easy to pray that for each student individually if I used the position in the class. And another thing I often prayed for was a sound mind and a healthy body. One thing I don't like to do is teach when you're not feeling quite well. Another thing I prayed for quite frequently is something that went a little bit like this, or prayed about, went a little like, God, I'm sorry, I'm done, can't take it anymore. And, you know, as I review those times, I realized that God wasn't sorry at all. In fact, it's almost as if he said, well, now we have him where we wanted him. Right? First year that I taught, I remember I took a restroom break, and I'd go like this, restroom, because it had nothing to do with the fixtures in a particular room. It had to do with peace and quiet. And I told God, I'm sorry, I won't do this again. Just get me through this year. In fact, get me through this afternoon, and I'll not be so foolish again. And again, it was one of those times when it seems like when we give it to God, and it helps with our patience. It helps with our frustrations. The Serenity Prayer. Do you know it? God, grant me the wisdom to accept the things I cannot change. You know, we're trying to produce new behaviors in people. That's hard stuff, to get somebody to behave differently, even to think differently. God, grant me the serenity to accept things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, the wisdom to know the difference. And another prayer that I often prayed was something just like, God, we need mercy, mercy. Mercy for me, mercy for my students. God, give us another chance. Well, the Bible says, if any of you lack wisdom, let him what of God? Say it. Ask of God, that what to all men liberally? It's printed, isn't it? Giveth to all men liberally, and upbraideth not, and it shall be what?
Given him.
That's a promise. Get a hold of it. Claim it. Realize it. Know about it. Use it. Right? Because you need it. Not that we're sufficient of ourselves to think anything of ourselves. But our sufficiency is of who?
God.
God. Amen. Amen. Preparing expectations is my next point. I don't know what you're expecting your students to do, how you're expecting them to perform, but I'm going to read you a story. It's story time, and it's not a real short story. I'm just going to read it, and when I'm done, I'm going to move on to the next point. So story time. I stood like a rock in a rushing stream of preoccupied Bible college students. It was fall registration. Organized chaos. I'd seen it all before many times, but this time, instead of racing around the gymnasium signing up for classes, I watched as students signed up for my classes. It was my first year out of graduate school, and I was just hours away from the debut on the other side of the lectern. Taking a closer look at several of the registration tables, I noticed that I had been assigned section 1, 2, and 3 of the course called Bible Study Methods. The remaining five sections were taught by others. After walking around for 20 minutes, I left the gym and headed across the campus toward my office. A well-seasoned faculty member at the college caught up with me and said, I just can't believe it. You can't believe what? They gave you section 2, didn't they? Well, yes, I guess they did. He shook his head in seeming disbelief. I just can't believe it. You're the new faculty member, first year rookie, and they give you Section 2? He had me perplexed. Well, what's so special about Section 2? You mean they didn't tell you that in faculty orientation? Truth was, I was the only new faculty member that year, so they didn't have faculty orientation, so I asked him to explain it to me. Well, Section 2 is all the top high school seniors coming into freshman class. The honors group, cream of the crop, every one of them. The most outstanding group of students in the whole college. We stopped outside the faculty offices, and he leveled his gaze at me. Bruce, you're not going to believe the difference in teaching Section 2. What do you mean, I asked, not knowing whether to feel exhilaration or intimidation. Growing up, I had never been a Section 2, at least I didn't think. All right, what are we talking about? E-word, expectations, yes. And he says, motivation, like a team of wild horses straining at the reins. Those kids will just pull it out of you. You're going to love every minute of it. Wow, first year teacher, I can't believe the luck. I walked down the sidewalk shaking his head. He walked down the sidewalk shaking his head. I was intrigued, to say the least. The next day, Section 1 filed in. We had a good hour. Nothing outstanding, just a good give-and-take session with a solid group of young men and women. After break, Section 2 walked in, and I couldn't believe it. He was absolutely right. I could feel the electricity in the air from the ring of the bell. Class just flew by as a teacher and student learned at almost warp speed. It was like stepping on a surfboard and riding the crest of the wave the entire hour. At times, the class's interest and desire to learn swept over me with such intensity that I had trouble staying on top of it. Everything seemed different. Their questions, their eye contact, their facial expressions, even the way they sat in their chairs. It was incredible. My colleague was right. These students pulled the best right out of you. Section 3 came in later that day, and I realized in only a few seconds that they were just like Section 1. Good, yes, but nowhere near the caliber of Section 2. As the semester progressed, I found myself increasingly grateful to God for leading me into the ministry of teaching. I never felt so challenged and fulfilled, and although I enjoyed all my classes, Section 2 always made my day. As we neared midterms, I found myself walking to a faculty meeting with the academic dean, Dr. Joseph Wong. Well, Bruce, he said, you're at the halfway point of your first year. The honeymoon's over by now. How do you enjoy teaching here at college? It's absolutely terrific, better than I imagined. He smiled. Well, that's great to hear. What's your favorite part? Without thinking, I blurted out, Section 2. He raised his eyebrows and stopped walking in order to listen more intently, I thought. You have Section 2. Tell me about it. It was the first chance I had to express my delight and gratitude for the opportunity to teach 30 of the keenest students I had ever encountered. I sung their praises for a couple of minutes as I described the amazing difference between them and the rest of my classes. The dean looked thoughtful as I went on and on about this gifted group of young men and women. When I had finished, he said, I'm glad you're having so much success, Bruce, but I need to tell you something that may surprise you. There is no honors class this year. We canceled it. My mouth went dry. Joe, I said, you've got to be kidding. No, I'm not kidding. Last year, we decided it would be better if we spread those top students through all the classes. We thought it would add a little more spark to each of the sections. Dizzy with disbelief, I said, Joe, I'll catch you in a few minutes. I need to go back to my office for a moment. I raced into my office, dialed the registrar, sure that my colleague was trying to pull something over me, being the rookie. Joyce, I said, I've got Section 2 of Bible study methods, right? That's right, Bruce. And then I swallowed hard. And Joyce, Section 2 contains all the outstanding students, the top freshmen, right? Well, no, Bruce, we canceled that program last year. Groaning inwardly, I thanked her and hung up the phone. I couldn't seem to come to grips with what was happening. With reluctance, I reached for my grade book and opened it. I compared the grades of Section 1 and 3 with Section 2. The difference was staggering. I pulled a stack of ungraded papers off my bookshelf. Stacking Section 1 and 3 on top of each other, I compared that pile with the stack from Section 2 by itself. Section 2 had more pages than the other two sections combined. I went through the pages one by one, page by page, and the difference was dramatic. The Section 2 students outshone their peers again and again, solid evidence. That day proved to be one of the most dramatic learning experiences of my life. I've never quite gotten over it. For the first time, I realized that what I believed about my students made an incredible difference in what they learned in my class. You see, there was no real difference between Sections 1, 2, and 3. It was the same content, the same day of the week, the same pool of 18- and 19-year-old students. Not one difference. In fact, never once did I even say, your section 2 and your performance ought to reflect it. Then how could I explain such a dramatic difference in what these students learned? The only difference was the teacher's E-word, say it.
Expectations.
Because of my expectations were so much higher for section 2, so was their behavior and learning. I'll never forget sitting back in my chair and saying to myself, I wonder what would have happened that day if that faculty member had told me the outstanding students were in section 3. All right, next, know your students. Know your students. Now, this is something that if you're not teaching in your home community, you might not even know their names. But you can learn, you should have it pretty high on your priorities when the year begins, to learn your students' personalities. Some are introverted, some are extroverted, and a host of other differences. Learn those personalities and relate to them accordingly, according to wisdom there. Learn their predilections, their interests. And then you can use those things when you're talking about math, when you're talking about need an illustration, draw from that student that seems the least engaged. Draw their favorite hobby or subject into the conversation. Develop your relationship with them. You can do that now. You can do it this week. About this time of the year, I always send a postcard to my students about like this. You can get one like this if you're in Oregon. Your students aren't, and you can get one that says Oregon. Just say, hi, it's me and your name there. And say, I'm in Oregon right now at WFTI. Just trying to figure out how we can have a good year together. See you soon. Right? It's just planting a seed for that relationship. You can get their school records and study them. Your school probably has a file that has a copy of their report cards or achievement tests. When I went to a new school, I did that somewhere here. Yes, I made a paper for each student. I used the last year's annual, and I cut out the picture and put it there. I put their name at the top, and I put how many years they were at the school, and I put something about their academics. I got this off their achievement test. You can get it off the report cards, what their high subject is, what their low subject. And by the time these students walked into my classroom, I kind of knew them already. Right? You can help yourself in that way. I also had to learn these names. This is Luba Kovalenko, and that's Vika Eckert, Eugene Kovalenko, and Ivan Kapustin, Vita Savchuk, and so on. I had to learn these different names, being in different different culture. Know your school. We're at point 4 now. Know your school. Brother Howard is talking to us about school culture. That's A. School culture simply means what they do, how they do it, the games, times of assembly for devotions, choir practice, procedure for assembly times, recess times. How are you going to know that? You're basically just going to have to ask questions, right? Hopefully there's a staff member there that you're not all new. You can borrow from them. If everybody's new, well, you can talk to the school board about these things. How does your community regard learning? What areas need encouragement? For the most part, if you're new there, you're going to have to just cooperate with school culture and work with it as it is. Wait to introduce major reform until you know it's good, until people know where you're headed and what you're trying to do, and they trust you. But school culture is a pretty powerful thing. I remember one morning in my CLE work, I visited one school, and it didn't take very long at all walking in the door. You could tell right away that the school culture there was very diligent, very studious. Students were quiet. All rooms, they were engaged. They were on task, that word that you wanted, you know, that condition every teacher needs to achieve and be concerned about. Everybody everywhere was on task. And went to the next school. Well, let me back up a little bit. I'm getting my story. I think I might have it wrong. But, okay, that was one school. The other school went to the same day. People were restless. People were not on task. And the teachers there were saying, does CLE really expect the students to get all this work done? Well, interestingly enough, the school that I told you about first, School 1 and School 2, they had almost identical curriculum. And I asked at the other school, I said, are the students getting their work done? Oh, yeah, no problem with that. What was the difference? It was school culture, right? These are things that become obvious as we work with school more. Yes, we can try to change culture in those types of ways, but you know, when it comes to totally revolutionizing things that are, you know, of a major revolutionary thing, those don't change fast. I mean, you don't change fast after all, do you? I don't change fast. When you're working with a group of people, change comes even slower and harder. Another thing about knowing your school is you need to know your school structure. I'm thinking now whether it's church-sponsored or patron-sponsored, right? Many of us, many Mennonite churches, have a church-sponsored school, right? This is not the case everywhere. Some schools are patron-sponsored. Either one can work, but there is a difference. The difference is mainly on who's most responsible for the school. In a patron-sponsored school, well, your patrons will have far more direct access to you as a teacher than in a church-sponsored school. Those are things that we ought to know about. All right, know your curriculum. Point five. So when you get to your school, there's going to be a box of books somewhere, and that will be the book order. There's going to be a bookshelf somewhere, or maybe a stack of books on the table in the back or something. That will be the curriculum that was used last year. You've got to make order of all that stuff. Right? Well, school subjects do divide into, I would say, kind of like two different main categories. So one is skill subjects. Math is a skill. Language is a skill. Reading is a skill. Then we have content subjects. Science, social studies, Bible, where the main emphasis is not how to read, how to multiply fractions, but it's rather the emphasis being on the content. Okay? So the skill subjects are ones that you want to be sure that you're covering well. We need good mathematicians, and we need good readers, and we need masters of the language, those three areas being the skill subjects. The others then are not as important. Important, of course, but how we teach and the importance we give skill subjects versus content subjects, two different things. Another thing that you should try to discern quickly is how does your book present the material? Your book is, your school textbooks basically are going to come to you in one of two formats. The one, is a chapter unit orientation. The other, I'm just going to call it spiral. Okay? So if we're going to learn about, let's say, nouns, and here's the level that the students are understanding nouns. At this point, they have a fifth grade understanding of nouns. If this represents a sixth grade level of understanding of nouns, a chapter approach is going to start out with a rather easy lesson about what are nouns. Sort of going to get you oriented, find nouns, and so on. Next lesson is going to take another aspect of nouns and another aspect of nouns and yet another and finish up with something more complex such as noun clauses. And then there's going to be a review and then there'll be a test and then you're done. You've studied that year's worth of nouns. And yes, there may be some review, but the review that they have after they're done with the chapter or the unit on nouns, that review will not ever be tested again. They've taken their test on nouns, and it's done. This method works, and it works very well, right? The spiral method, instead, we start from here, and we go to here. Again, the two levels representing the same thing, fifth grade understanding of nouns, a sixth grade understanding of nouns. Instead, it introduces the material incrementally, and it has review every day. There's a little bit of material introduced and then it comes around and hits it again in review. And so instead of being a ramp,
it's kind of like one of these kind of ramps. You know, you go around and around and around, and kind of like a parking garage ramp or a shopping mall, right? This lesson, this type of lesson, has perhaps 70% review and 30% new material. This lesson is probably going to have, of the student work that is, of the student work 70-30, here we're going to have more like 80% new work and 20% review. First year that I taught Rod and Staff English, which is the chapter unit method. And I was one of those students that did rather poorly in school with language. If I had put as much effort in figuring out how to master English as I did in how little I could do to still get by, I would have mastered the subject. So I was staying as a teacher one day ahead of grade 7 to 10, which is what I had the first year I taught. And I thought, as a price of survival, I'm just going to do this. And I X'd out the review, and I never signed a review that whole first year I taught. I'm embarrassed to say so, but I'm just telling you the truth. All right, and it worked. We got by. The students were passing their tests. They were doing fine, in fact. They were doing very well because they didn't have to do the review. I mean, they were feeling good about it. No way you can pull a review out of a spirally oriented curriculum. Now, you can't do that because the review actually is a large part of the teaching material. If I have to teach a new textbook, that's one of the first things I would do. Try to figure out to what method, according to what pattern, are they introducing material, and how are they using the review. That way you can get in sync with it. All right, there's more that could be said about this, but maybe we'll say this yet. This type of learning experience emphasizes learning the content. We're going to learn the content very well, and out of content we learn process. It's a content to process emphasis. This type of material tends to emphasize process. We're going to learn the process. And out of the process, we learn concept. Was I saying content? Okay, I meant to say this is from concept to process. This tends to be from process to concept. All right, now let's just make that practical. I don't know where their shoes are, and I'm not inclined to take mine off. But how did your mother tell you to tie your shoes? Did she go from process to concept, or did she go from concept to process? Well, think about it. Did she say, now what we really need here, Junior, when we tie shoes, is we need something that it makes a nice, good, solid knot and won't give. But you need to also be able to untie it very quickly. So because of that, we need... Does that sound like your mother teaching you? No. She taught you from process to concept. She said, first of all, you get the two strings, and you put the one under the other, and then you go, all right? And after that, you make a rabbit ear, right? And after you did that process about 50 times, guess what? You began to realize, this is really a brilliant concept. See? Both methods work. Now, CLE would be this way. Rebecca Math would be this way. Right? Talking about knowing your curriculum. Let's go to know your schedule, the sixth item here. And I think the two that we have under there would be personal life and school life, these two dimensions of schedule. You know, one of the things I miss about teaching school is I miss the external demands that it puts on me. If you want time to go fast, teach school. It's a very daily experience. When you get done teaching one day, you have to get ready for the next day because it's coming, one second at a time, marching at you. Right? So your personal life, it's good to create a time budget. Know what time you're going to get up. So many things go wrong simply because we didn't do the right thing at the right time. If we can get up in the right time, it's a great start. It's a good day, for instance. I think it's great to have a pretty much of a standard time that I get to school at whatever works best for you. I tend to be a morning person. When it gets to be about 8, after 8 o'clock, boys my age start thinking about bed, right? Some people, 11 o'clock comes and they're just starting to
finally they got their stride. They've been struggling for it all day. And from 11 to 1, a good teacher friend of mine, you may know him too. You know what his email is? TeacherNightOwl@yahoo.com. His email address is. It's not me, right? But you need to know where you work best and work your personal schedule for most effectiveness and efficiency. School life. Get last year's schedule. On the top of many teachers' desks, this one doesn't have it. It must have been peeled off, or maybe it wasn't used last year here as a full-time classroom. But there's got to be last year's schedule somewhere. Get it. Benefit from it. It'll tell you right there what time school starts. It'll tell you what time you had breaks and how long. It'll tell you what the teacher put in the various spaces the year before. Now, most teachers need to carefully budget their time because we just don't have that much of it. We're spread fairly thin. So figure out how many times each subject must be had a week. You can tell that from looking at the previous year's schedule. Maybe you need to do some asking there, or about knowing your curriculum. Maybe this fits there. Go back and say, okay, well, this history book has, 300 pages, and we have 160 days of school, and I'd like to have history. Let's see, how would 3 days a week work? Well, that leaves you with, figure out how many days you have and divide by how many days and start getting a feel. How fast do we really need to progress through this book? But you really need to build a schedule. For myself, when I went to teach school, when I started a new school term, the first thing I would always do is get the book order figured out. First thing, I'd write on the board, who are my students and what grades? And I'd get a table, something like this, and I'd start stacking books on it. And sometimes it took a few hours. Sometimes it took all day because there were a lot of gaps. The person who ordered the books might have been yours truly, might not have been. We have to call the publisher and get those books coming. That's why it's a good thing to do the books first. After that, the next thing I tried to do was a schedule. And again, might take a few hours if the year was similar to the previous. If it wasn't, if you're new at the school and you got a schedule done in 1 day, well, that's wonderful. That's what you did that day. If it takes you all day to get a schedule put together, that's okay. That's fine. It's part of preparation. And then after you had those big things out of the way, then you start working at other things like whether your classroom theme is going to be lighthouses or ladybugs and things like that. I think it's pretty easy for us to get this switched around. Don't worry so much about classroom decor. You can add that even in the first week if these other big pieces didn't come together for you as well as they could have or should have. We're talking about knowing your schedule and how important it is to build the schedule. Next item here is prepare your records. Some of these need to be done before school starts, some of them after. There should be a planner. That's A, teacher's planner. And you can choose to do this on computer. You can choose to do this by paper. In tablets, there are plenty of school teachers' planners available, good planners available. I always did it on paper because I like to be able to use the eraser button, as was talked about in the last section. But write down what you're going to assign. Write down the break times. Write down the memory work that you're going to assign. Those things all belong to teacher's planner. Teacher's grade book. Get that set up so that when you start getting grades, you can put them in beside the correct names. And get figured out. Or if you're taking daily grades, how are you going to notate the difference between daily grades and quizzes and tests? It's another thing you ought to know, part of your school culture, is how does your school grade? Do they want a grade on every subject, every day, or are they only recording grades on quizzes and tests? Does that change with grade level? Those are all questions that you need to find out. And then part of laying out your grade book is, for me, it was pencil is daily work. Quizzes are in blue ink, and tests are in red ink. Way to keep track of what's what without getting too detailed about labels. C is a school handbook. You ought to ask if your school has a handbook. Don't expect something big and massive with a big professional wide binding like this. School handbook might be a few pieces of paper. Brother Howard read from theirs this morning. That school's been around for a long time. At least he's been around for a long time. And they have 8 pages, and that's their handbook. That's great. That's better than nothing. And it's probably sufficient. I would rather have a short, succinct collection of policies and rules and how we do things than an enormous one. You might also ask for a curriculum guide. Many schools have a list that say what they study when. In other words, what subjects, what curriculum provider, in what grade. And sometimes in the upper grades they begin to put things together, such as fourth and fifth history are together, or fifth and sixth history, and here's what we use on the odd number years, and here's what we use on the even number years. Find that. Get it. Have it. If your school doesn't have one, I challenge you to make one. At the end of the year, it's as easy as rolling off a log for that year anyway, right? Because by that time, you've been using the books for 160, 170, 180 days. So if your school doesn't have a curriculum guide, do all those people behind you a favor by making one. Make a curriculum guide. This is what we do around here. This is what we study. And then there ought to be a student permanent file record, probably in the office of the school. There's a file drawer. And in that permanent file record, there's things like the achievement test records. If your school gives achievement tests, then they should. Report cards, admission forms, any medical forms at your particular school. We're getting down to, we're moving on here, F and G. F is the admission form, parental consent form, medical record. I think these things are very important. I personally would not be comfortable at all teaching at a school where there's not those two things, an admission form or a parental consent form. In other words, a form that says, yes, I, senior, want junior to be at this school. And along with that, if there's any need for emergency medical care or things like that, we allow them to make decisions. One day after school, a number of years ago, I heard this horrendous yelling, and I went out there, and there was a sixth grade girl that I'm not sure exactly how it happened, but it had to do with a fourth grade boy holding a pipe, a section of pipe about that long in the ground. She was standing on that pipe. Not sure what the objective was, but something went wrong. It didn't take an expert to say what went wrong. And that pipe made a gouge in her leg unlike anything I've ever seen before. You could almost put this bottle in it. Right at that point, I scooped her up and climbed into the nearest minivan and told one of the other teachers, I said, go get Christina's file. And that teacher knew exactly what I meant. She went in there, and I carried her into the emergency room with a pack of papers like this under my shoulder. In today's culture, that pack of papers meant an awful lot to me, right? Imagine you carrying somebody into an emergency facility, and who are you? Well, the sixth grade girl was in no frame of mind to say anything, all right? But I just showed the papers. I said, she's a student at our school, and her name is Christina. You're Christina? Yeah, I'm Christina. Right? It was wonderful. And, that's why you need these kind of things. I think you need them before school begins, because when can these accidents happen? Anytime. Achievement test records ought to be in there, too. Right, prepare your classroom and other areas. We're talking now about desks, decor, those type of things. There's other areas, such as recreational areas. Check out the playground. I don't know why. Maybe if I would have checked out the playground, I would have found that piece of pipe. The school office can be arranged a little bit. The supply room, those kind of things. Know what's in there so that you're not spending your valuable time in the afternoon going and getting something you already have. Right? It might be in the school supply room, in the school office. It's too bad when you dismiss students on the first day of school and you're going to go play Foursquare, you're going to go play soccer. You don't have a ball to do it. Right? We're talking about preparing. All right, now, the remainder of the class period, we're going to deal with preparing to teach. Actually, what do we do? Law 1 of the 7 laws of teaching, which we'll be hearing about more later this week in one of these classes, says this: the teacher must be the one who knows the lesson or truth to be taught. Right? That makes sense, doesn't it? All right. Well, that's just the way those laws are. They're very simple, very basic to understand. And then that book proceeds to unpackage them further. We already talked about a textbook or a course overview. Look through that table of contents. Figure out what pace needs to be maintained. Notice the main features. Get to know the book. Right? There's a section in there that says, to the teacher. Read it. read it. One of the school reps not so long ago that works for CLE was sitting down with the teachers and getting their feedback about the curriculum. The first grade teacher said, you know, would CLE consider having a chart maybe or something for the learning to read curriculum that tells you exactly what you do every day in the workbook and in the activity book and just say everything that you're supposed to do every single day? The school rep had to jack his jaw up again because she was sitting there with the book and it had that in there. Right? She just missed it. I do things like that too, okay? Don't get me wrong, I'm not putting her down. But there's a lot of help right in the book. What she was asking for was already prepared for her to use. And this was two-thirds, three-quarters of the way through the year. Right? So don't make that kind of mistake. Spend time looking at it. If you're going to be the teacher, then you really need to know how to teach. If I'm going to be a farmer out here, one of the reasons I can't be a farmer is because these big machines, they scare me, frankly. They have all sorts of functions that I don't know how it's supposed to work. The bales that my baler would make, they probably wouldn't even stand upright, right? Because I don't know how the whole thing functions. Well, if you're going to be successful at what you're doing, you got to learn to know your baler. You got to learn to know your book. All right, thinking now of daily lesson preparations. This is going to be a crash course on getting ready to teach a lesson. Okay, so let's suppose we open up our book. And suppose this is a math book, and here I am at the right lesson. I see that it's about fractions. Never did like them in school. Right? So how are we going to actually prepare to teach this lesson? Well, there's really three steps. The one is identify the objectives. In the teacher material of today's textbooks, it says this lesson is to teach how to add fractions with unlike denominators. It's going to say something like that. Okay? So, you know, okay, what we're focusing on is a fraction with an unlike denominator, such as we're going to add 3/4 plus 5/8. Okay? See, 8 and 4 are not the same. Those are the denominators. Oh, okay, so today's lesson is teaching, we're going to have to understand how do we deal with this, right? And it's teaching students how to, all I'm saying is the objective all over again, right? Really, the wonderful thing about teaching school, yes, it's daily, and yes, it's aggressive, and yes, you have to have all this stuff in place, but each lesson is so small, right? It's just like, you played Mother May I already, right? And I always groaned a little bit. My sister was a great one for this. Johnny, take 1,000 PP steps. Right? And hoping that I trip up in the 1,000. Well, maybe it was 100. Whatever. You get the idea. That's what you're doing. PP steps. Right? Because you see, already they know, if it told you that we're going to add fractions, they already know what a fraction is. There's a lot of stuff that we already know, right? Step one, identify the objective. That's what you're learning. Step two is think about what skills are required to do the new skill. Okay? What is a new skill? The how. What and how. Okay? So once you've identified, oh, okay, so when we add fractions, we had learned before that we add the numerator, right? But in this lesson, it's telling us that we have to make like denominators. And the example, they're both eights in this case, so then we have to, you know, just add the numerator. Oh, okay, so we're adding the numerator just like we were yesterday. We're adding the numerator after we have the denominator alike. Okay? So you figure out what's being taught first, and then number two, you figure out how you do the new skill. Right? And oftentimes, if you tell the students what they need to know, so much of it is what they already know. That all you're doing is identifying that little PP step. Okay. So first of all, what are we learning? And then how are we doing it? And basically, so much of the lesson relates to review that it hardly is even funny. And if you plan the review on a skill-based lesson we're talking about now, math, English, or reading, if you plan the review, why, you have all the lesson except that one or two final step. Okay? And then what you need to do is you just need to pound those objectives. Practice it. That's step three. What to do, how to do it, and then demonstrate and practice. Bruce Wilkinson calls it work the minimums for mastery. Says every lesson, the objectives, he calls them the minimums for mastery. If we're going to master this lesson, we have to know at least this. Identify the minimums for mastery. And then work those essential points with the students. And keep on until they can demonstrate that they know the what and the how of the lesson. And we might add a fourth point, and that is do it the night before. Do it the night before. Far more important than checking is preparing to teach the new material. Now, I didn't say that you don't have to check, but do remember, you were hired to be a checker, right? No, you were hired to be a teacher. Part of being a teacher is indeed lesson checking. Yes, it is. But it's much safer schedule-wise to prepare for the next day's classes the night before. And then you can bring things from home. You need that bottle of Mountain Dew. It gives you time to soak on it, right? If you do it all the night before. Well, we said it was going to be a crash course. We crashed our way through there. Unfortunately, I was about in my fourth or fifth year of teaching before I realized what I just told you, that every lesson has an objective. I guess I just was slopping along in galoshes. I'm not sure. Just sort of, you know, being a teacher, right? Well, it's a whole lot more scientific than that. It's a whole lot more concise than that. It's something that you can get a hold of solidly. Three most important words are?
Preparation.
Got it. You got to choose now. Are you going to be proactive or are you going to be reactive? The one always produces better results. Thank you, and you're excused.